Open to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We're going to be looking at verses 12 through 26. Pretty much as soon as Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue and came back to say, hey, there's something in between us and China, Europeans assumed there must be a shortcut. A way to go over the top of the American continent and get to the Far East. They called this the Northwest Passage, and nations competed to discover it. For generations, they sent their best ships and captains out to search for such a shortcut, because it would have been amazingly lucrative to be able to trade with the Far East without going all the way down and around the bottom of Africa and across the Indian Ocean. And so for 10 generations, even though nobody found it, people refused to admit defeat. Until Captain James Cook, who was maybe the greatest nautical explorer in history, over the course of a series of voyages around the Pacific Ocean, Cook finally proved that the Northwest Passage didn't exist. And he actually proved it by searching from the other side. By going up and exploring the coast of Alaska, where no Europeans had been before. And then he even sailed along the southern edge of the polar ice cap until it converged with land, and he could say once and for all, it's not there. There's no shortcut. That process of discovery was repetitive, painstaking. It involved sailing along that exploring all the bays and eventually finding a spot where maybe, well, we could turn northeast and go look for it. And then realizing there was nothing there, backtracking hundreds of miles. I'm doing all this backwards, aren't I? You get the idea. Sailing further west, turning again, discovering it was not there, trying again and again until there was no shadow of a doubt. The book of Ecclesiastes that we're reading from today is about 3,000 years old. But even in that time, there was generations of evidence that the human quest to discover transcendence, to find some shortcut to being more than human, was futile. There was generations of evidence, and yet people had not admitted defeat. And so the author of Ecclesiastes goes out on a quest to try every possibility, to check every bay and inlet, and come back and report firsthand, I've been there. I've checked every possibility. There is no shortcut. There's no way for us to make ourselves more. We cannot test the limits and break through. The limits will break us. Even our best captains with our best ships, our wisest souls using the most diligent spiritual practices, cannot become more than human. And the implication, which comes at the end of our text, is pretty straightforward. Quit wasting your time trying. You've been given a human life. Don't spend it trying to make it into something it isn't. Enjoy it instead. In the earlier part of chapter 2, there's been a sort of broader search, trying every method, and this time the preacher returns to the best possible ones. So before, he tried like everything. Planting gardens, having concubines, drinking a lot, all of it. And here he just focuses on like the best chances we have are wisdom and work. If anything can lead us to transcendence, can help us become more than human, wisdom or work should be able to do the trick. And he comes back to say, nope, not those either. So there's three paragraphs in our passage. I'm going to read each paragraph before we kind of dive into it. But it's pretty straightforward. Wisdom can't make us more than human. Work can't make us more than human. That's a good thing. That's where we're going. So first, the first paragraph. Wisdom cannot make us more than human. This is verses 12 to 17. So, I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise and modest? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and a striving after the wind. It's not that wisdom is bad. It's that it can't make you more than human. Ecclesiastes is a book of wisdom. It comes in the section of the Bible called the wisdom literature. Wisdom is a good thing. It is a good ship to take out on the sea of life, right? Wisdom means the art of living well, of understanding the terrain of life and responding accordingly, right? Wisdom is a gardener who sees where the shade will be and arranges the plants accordingly. Wisdom is the builder who looks at the foundation and decides, you know what, we're going to take some extra time to shore this up and make it solid before we go on any further. Wisdom is the husband who sees his wife's face and understands from the topography there whether to offer feedback or to offer hot chocolate. Right? And wisdom is good. It has value. It's better than the alternative, than foolishness. It's better not to put your foot in your mouth. It's better not to build your house on the sinking sand. It's better not to waste perfectly good flowers, leaving them to wither for lack of sunlight. Wisdom is good, but it does not a thing to change the brute fact, the hard limit of death. In the end, the wisest marriage ends. The most solidly founded building crumbles. In the end, every gardener replaces her flowers in the ground with herself. Wisdom is good, but it can't make us more than human. Not only that, trying to use wisdom to make you more than human leads not just to failing at that, but to hating life. That's the conclusion in verse 17. So I hated life. Right? Wisdom is good, but if you look to wisdom to be more than good, if you look to it to be God, to make you more than human, not only will you be disappointed with wisdom, you'll be disgusted with life. Think of this. Think of wisdom applied to your physical health, to tending and caring for your body. Wisdom is good. It is good to understand your body and what sorts of things will benefit it. Right? It is good to stretch. It is good to drink more water and eat less Halloween candy. Right? It is good at the end of the evening to leave your phone in the kitchen so that when you get into bed, you can sleep instead of scroll. Wisdom is good. But if wisdom is about understanding your body, then fundamental to that wisdom is understanding that your body is going to die. That the honest goal of a physically healthy lifestyle is to experience the exact same decay as everybody else, a little later and a little slower. Right? If you don't accept that hard limit, and if you look to wisdom, not to keep you a little healthier for a little longer, but to conquer death, to let you stay healthy indefinitely, not only will you fail, but you will waste all of the life that you're given in this foolish quest to avoid dying. And along the way, every extra pound, every bad lab result, Every time you go to the gym and see someone who looks like they're a little healthier than you are, will be its own little death in advance, its own crushing reminder that your life is actually meaningless and miserable, that you're pursuing something that doesn't exist. After all, like my favorite folk singer who grew up down the road from my grandparents in North Carolina, his name is Mike Cross, and he said, "Listen here, brother, life's just another terminal disease." Wisdom is good. Treating wisdom as God is foolishness. So don't try to become wise enough to be more than human. Don't try to become wise enough to conquer death. The quest will kill you early. Wisdom is good, but it can't make us more than human. Of course, there's no way to be wise enough to avoid dying, to dodge mortality. But, I mean, can't you sort of outlive death by leaving something lasting behind you? Can't you create some kind of legacy, right? Captain Cook died over 240 years ago, and people are still talking about him, right? There's got to be some way to sort of fudge it. We'll just set aside how unusual a human being Captain Cook is and how unlikely it is that anyone in this room or anyone knows in this room will accomplish that much in a lifetime, right? Ecclesiastes is written in the persona of someone who achieved more than Captain Cook, whose legacy outmatches his. And it's written to tell us there's no list of achievements, there's no amount of or type of work we can do that will make us more than human. Work is like wisdom. It's good for being human. It's useless for becoming God. Work won't make you more than human. This is 18 to 23. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. Look, work is good. Like wisdom, it is one of the fundamental things we were made for, to do things that are worth doing well. A couple of months ago, the dishwasher in my house started making this funny whirring noise. And then it started filling up with water at the bottom. And then it stopped washing dishes. Which, if you know the number of people who eat in my house, right, we almost called FEMA. It's a big deal for the dishwasher not to work. Right? But in the course of a single evening, without even going to Home Depot, with a little bit of help from YouTube and my friend Taylor, I fixed the dishwasher. I disassembled the drain, found the torn up rubber band that had gotten tied up in the little propeller thing that I don't understand what it does, and I took the rubber band out and I reassembled it all right the first time, and it washed a load of dishes. And Zach saith, "Behold, it was very good." Right? Like, that sense of satisfaction, which the reason I can tell you this story so enthusiastically is because it's very unusual for me in appliances, right? Brian knows, he's been over there to clean up my appliance repair messes multiple times. Right? That sense of satisfaction is meant to be there. Right? We're made to do work that's worth doing and do it well. And that applies to all kinds of work to a story well told, or a wound well healed, or a song well sung, or a bridge well engineered, or a toilet well cleaned. Work is a good part of being human. But it's not eternal. It's not transcendent. It won't make us more than human. Ecclesiastes is written by a wise man sometime after the time of King Solomon, using King Solomon's voice. Right? Solomon was the sort of most accomplished and wise king in the history of Israel. And that's why our text started with that weird question, for what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has been done before. Right? The wise man is saying, look, you're not going to outdo Solomon when it comes to wisdom and work. Right? But an important thing to know about King Solomon is how his story ends. Right? Solomon spent his life doing these massive, marvelous works. He built this temple that was the greatest structure anyone in the nation had ever seen, and that outlasted him by hundreds of years. He built the nation of Israel into this international power, this hub of trade from north to south, from west to east. He built an army that could preemptively keep the peace because no one wanted to mess with him and all of his chariots and horses and paid soldiers. Right? He worked. And then Solomon died, and the kingdom of Israel passed to his spoiled idiot son, Rehoboam. You can go read about this in the first book of Kings. And Rehoboam promptly threw a royal temper tantrum of such a scale that by the time he was done kicking and screaming, 9/10 of the nation of Israel had said no thanks and left to form a different country. Solomon outworked you and me and all of our friends put together. And before his body was cold in the grave, his legacy was falling apart. Work is good. It is a good part of being human. But it will never make you more than human. It has value, but not value that lasts. This, I think, is important for us to recognize in our age, that just like wisdom is good for life, but trying to use it to conquer death ruins life, work is good for life, but looking to work to make something more out of our lives will turn our lives into something less. Specifically, the text shows us that trying to use work to become something more takes the good rhythm of work and rest and turns it into toil and despair. This is what he's trying to articulate, his experience of going from work and rest to toil and despair in this paragraph. He uses the word toil 7 times here. He's trying to drum home the dreary repetitiveness of it. It's a different word from the Hebrew word for work, and it conveys labor, but haunted by purposelessness. Okay? So work is good, right? A good meal well made is work. And that is good. Toil is preparing the exact same meal for children you know full well will act as if you have waged war against their souls because you had the audacity to put a few well-sautéed vegetables in the chicken Alfredo. Same labor, but now it has become toil. Because it has been robbed of its good purpose, right? The purpose of cooking a good meal is not just nourishment. It's fellowship and celebration and thanksgiving, right? This version is toil because even as you season the chicken and boil the pasta and chop the onions, you know it's all in vain. That it will not result in fellowship, but in dissension and revolt. It will not result in celebration, but profound, voluminous whining. Right? Not that I'm speaking from experience. Toil is good work haunted by purposelessness. Now, what if the purpose you're looking for in work is transcendent, is eternal? is to make you more than human? What if I'm not cooking the meal to enjoy fellowship and nourishment and celebration, but to validate my own existence? To prove that I'm a good enough dad for my children and their children and their children and their children to remember my chicken Alfredo forever. Well, now, no matter how the meal is received, it's going to be toil. Because that purpose is never gonna happen. Work is good, but it's not good enough for that. And so now all the work that I do turns into toil. As long as I'm reaching through work for something more than human, work becomes toil. And rest becomes despair. In a good work, you get to rest from it. You get to lay it down and be at peace. But in toil, you don't. This is verse 23. For all of his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. Despair is rest wrecked by purposelessness. Because now, instead of laying down my work and being at peace, I lay down the thing that distracts me from the hollow hopelessness of my life. And there's nothing left for me to do but toss and turn. I can make my body still, but my heart and soul won't cooperate. Work, you can rest from and go to bed. Toil follows you into bed and haunts your dreams. If this is you, you're not alone. In fact, if this is you, it's probably because we live in a place and time that makes toil seem like a necessary and normal feature of life. In our age, work, even more than wisdom, is our preferred path to transcendence. We live in this culture of toil and despair. The poet Christian Wiman says it this way: ask anyone how they're doing this these days, and the most frequent response will be some form of busy or tired. If someone asks you today how you're doing, and you don't reflexively say, "Oh, I'm fine," would the first honest answer be some form of busy or tired? Wyman says, we all feel there is somehow less time than there once was to satisfy the feverish need we have to fill every hour of every day with measurable tasks and accomplishments. Think about that in light of this reality. We are a culture in which surviving takes less work than ever before. We have access to more labor-saving devices and social safety nets than any previous generation. And so whatever exhausted busyness we experience, it's not about staying alive. It's not about having enough. Rather, it's about striving to make something more out of life and finding that we have less and less. It's about spending our lives chasing something, about distracting ourselves from the reality that no matter what, our lists of tasks and accomplishments can't save us, even if we got to add all of the things we daydream about adding. They can't justify our existence. They can't make life worth living. Work is good, but looking to work to make us more only makes us less. It turns us not into superhumans, but into mechanical creatures of toil and despair. So should we give up? I mean, this sounds miserable. There's no such thing as becoming wise enough or working hard enough to make life worth living. Does that make work and wisdom and life itself ultimately worthless? That's not the conclusion the author of Ecclesiastes draws. He says, arriving at those places of tossing and turning and being unable to rest at night, of being vexed and hating life, gives us the opportunity to recognize that God is eager to give us what we cannot get for ourselves. Work can't make us more than human. Wisdom can't make us more than human. The goal of life was never to be more than human. We were made to be human and to receive what we need from a generous God. This is the last paragraph. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving after the wind. Ecclesiastes says, work and wisdom will never get us above because they are gifts from above. They don't lift us up, they come down to us. They are from the hand of God, verse 24. Work and wisdom make awful gods, awful paths to becoming more than human. But as gifts from the hand of God, they make wonderful goods, wonderful helps in being human. That is a lesson we learn repetitively over time, over the course of our lives. One of the wiser men I know is named Roy Yankee, and he says that all of life is lived in this progression from being naive to being disillusioned to being hopeful. There's no way to bypass any part of that. We go from naive to disillusioned to hopeful over and over and over again. Right? We start with the naive assumption, I want there to be a Northwest Passage, therefore there must be. I want there to be some way to become more than human, therefore that there must be. And then life disillusions us. And that makes it possible for us to live, hopefully, in the world as it is, not in the world as we imagined it to be. Example, I grew up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, another college town, the son of a professor at the university. And so I absorbed, I think they put it in the water with a little bit of chlorine, the philosophy that wisdom in the form of higher education is a sort of Northwest Passage to the good life. A shortcut to a life full of meaning and promise and prosperity. Naive. My naivete died a pretty hard and fast death upon graduating from one of those prestigious universities. I found myself working not as a consultant in some sort of high-powered firm or an intern, you know, in a hospital preparing to become a surgeon. I found myself working as a carpenter's helper, carrying sheets of plywood at the direction of a foreman who, forget prestigious universities, had not finished high school. If I had been more mature at 22, the whole experience could have been really humbling. As it was, I just found it humiliating. It disillusioned me. And a few weeks into this, I called my mom to check in, grumble about it. And my mom, bless her, did not respond. Zachary, you entitled snob. You have a job in the middle of a recession. Shut up, pay your bills, and give thanks. Could have legitimately said all of that, didn't say any of it. Instead, what she said was, Zachary, this job is a gift. Yeah, it's going to pay your bills, and yeah, it's going to teach you skills that are going to allow you to tell sermon illustrations about fixing dishwashers 20 years from now. And it's going to free you from the idea that you can be wise enough, educated enough, to somehow become more than human. Only having been disillusioned could I receive the job I had as a gift. Working wasn't going to validate my existence or launch me onto some transcendent career path. It wasn't going to make me more than human. But once, with the help of someone else's wisdom, I accepted that, work could become a gift. Right? All of life can be this way. Right? Yeah, the work of your job, or the work of friendship or marriage or parenting, the work of growing up or growing old, the work of maintaining the house or participating in the church, all of it can become a gift from above. All of it can be part of us learning what the preacher of Ecclesiastes is trying to teach us, to stop striving and start receiving. Your need for more, your dissatisfaction with who you are, it's not going away. It's not really meant to go away. Right? That's why in a society that knows more and has more than ever before, we keep hunting for more in all sorts of unlikely places. Right? As if education or parenting or careers or politics or sports or travel could do the job. We keep looking because we can't stop longing. Right? In the words of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, God has put eternity on our hearts. Or in the words of Aldous Huxley, humanity has a basic need for self-transcendence. Or my personal favorite, in the words of Belle at the beginning of Beauty and the Beast, there must be more than this provincial life. We're made to long for more, but that doesn't mean we have to hunt more down. Doesn't mean we have to try to achieve it in our own strength. We don't have to strive. We can receive instead. We can let more come to us, and we can learn to enjoy him. That's the point in the last verse in 26, which is not the easiest to interpret, right? For the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. Wait, what? That sounds like God divides the world into those who please him and sinners, and then rewards each accordingly. And so we should probably try to be wise enough and work hard enough to get out of the sinners category and into the those who please God category. Except that that's the opposite of what the author has been saying all along. Except that that is a recipe for toil and despair. If we read the text, that verse, more faithfully and deeply, it shows us something different. The Hebrew of verse 26, it doesn't begin, "for to the one who pleases him." It begins, "for to the one who sits well before his face." For to the person who sits well before the face of God. And then please notice this. It does not say, "God will give wisdom and knowledge and joy in response to our sitting well." It says God has already given wisdom and knowledge and joy, and that we respond by sitting well before God's face. So the groups here are not God's favorites and God's not favorites. The groups are the people who recognize life is a gift to be received, not something to be earned or achieved, and receive that gift from God and sit before his face. And people who can't accept the goodness and the generosity of God, and so they waste their lives out gathering and collecting, striving after the wind, trying to gather up enough whatever, wisdom or work or achievement or anything, only to discover that it's a heap of vanity in the end. Much later in the Bible, Jesus goes to visit the home of two sisters, Martha and Mary. And Martha goes to work. Good work. It says she welcomed Jesus into her home and that she did much serving. Hospitality and serving are good work. But Martha needed to do enough of them to earn her place. Her sister Mary, on the other hand, sat before the face of Jesus and enjoyed his presence. Because she understood there was nothing left to earn, that she didn't need to get to God. because God had come to her. Martha is us, is the spirit of our age, even in church. Can we do enough on behalf of God to earn his favor? Mary is God's invitation to us to sit well before his face and receive wisdom, knowledge, the Hebrew word there means ability, capacity to work, and a third thing that comes up two more times in this paragraph, joy. Right? Joy is the experience of being with someone who's glad to be with you. Joy is sitting well before the face of God because you know that God is glad to be with you. That he doesn't need you to earn his favor. He has come to shower it upon you. That's the invitation of verse 26 of this passage of Scripture. An invitation to lay down the burden, the striving of Martha, and learn to be Mary. It's not, to be clear, an invitation never to work or seek wisdom again, but an invitation to, in the joy of the presence of God, receive work and wisdom as gifts from the one who, although he was more, became human in order to sit with us face to face. Of course, this sitting before God to experience his gladness to be with us, it's only possible if God really is generous. Only possible if God is really glad to be with us. It doesn't work if God is real but absent or aloof or arbitrary or stingy or any of the other things we might imagine him to be. If those are true, then we might as well just keep striving. But in Jesus, God has shown us who he is. He's shown himself to be not absent, but present with us to the end of the age. Shown himself to be not aloof, but gentle and lowly in heart. He's shown himself to be not arbitrarily playing favorites, but a friend to tax collectors and sinners. Shown himself to be not stingy, but here to give himself as a ransom for us. In Jesus, God shows you and me and anyone who will stop pursuing their feverish need to fill every hour of every day with lists of measurable tasks and accomplishments, and instead sit before his face. He shows us he is willing to go to any length to give us not just wisdom and work, but joy. That's the more you were made for. That's the more you're longing for. It's the more you are never going to achieve, no matter how hard you work or how wise you become. It's the more you don't need to achieve, because in Jesus, God has already given himself to you. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your good gifts that come down from above, for wisdom, for work, and above all for your Son who came down not just to be human, but to stand in our place, who endured the cross for the joy set before him, the joy of being with us. Help us, Father, to believe that you are glad to be with us. Set us free from our foolish striving. Set us free to receive your wisdom, your work, all of your good gifts as they come down from above. Amen.